That's just tomorrow.
You're lucky you got a camp.
Exactly.
Took me a long enough time.
Nice to have you here.
I just never understood.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real pleasure to welcome to Earth Arua at Matan Greenberg is the Rosh Yeshivah of the Yeshivah Bat Ayin. Now, also here from Yeshivah Bat Ayin is Rabbi Yehoshua Lutz. Yehoshua, say hello. Rabbi Yehoshua is involved in development and sort of helping to forge the structural future of the yeshiva, and is responsible for some of these trips that Rabbi Nachman takes. So it's a real pleasure to welcome you both here. Of the people here, at least three of us were present at the smicha last June. So some of us have some contact with yeshiva. For those of you who don't know, my own personal connection to Yeshiva Bat Ayin is through Ezra. Ezra, our son, was a product of this congregation and another synagogue. And Ezra was an interesting guy, still is, very interesting guy.
Is.
He still is. And Ezra's had his own spiritual search, and one of the powerful things that I saw, as I'm sure others of you who have gone through this with your children have seen, is that often he makes decisions that are surprising, and when you begin to think about them, they're so wonderful that you're really glad that he didn't ask you first. Because he walks into another world. A world that I didn't actually know so well. I studied a little bit of Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav when I was in the seminary, but it was the sort of thing that you did on the fringes of the Jewish Theological Seminary. We pushed it a little bit with Heschel. We then had a very small seminar. There were three of us studying Likutei Moharan, about which we'll hear more, with Rabbi Avram Holtz, who's professor of literature. And it never occurred to me, although it occurred to me then, the strength of the literature. My friend and almost classmate Art Green wrote a book on a biography. Come, sit down.
Thank you.
Of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. But I never really understood, I must say, the power of it all until I grew a lot older. And I must say that until I had more involvement with Israel, until I saw the way in which some literature and the whole way of looking at the world really covered the basis of theology and psychology, and I saw my own children reading Rabbi Nachman, the way, frankly, that I read Freud at a certain age. I left Freud. But I could see what they were getting out of it was something extraordinary. Ezra's years of study at Bat Ayin are fantastic, just fantastic. I was privileged to, Naomi and I were privileged to visit numerous times. I spent several Shabbatot at Bat Ayin. And I can see what is so extraordinary about one yeshiva that tries to develop inner personality. And it deals with all the outside issues of being a Jew in the modern world. And that really tries to develop a sense of the presence of God and of making that presence real to the people who are there, making it live. But all such institutions really are the products of their leaders. And this is Rav Nachman's institution. So I just consider it a great privilege that we have the opportunity to have Rav Nachman Greenberg with us. Rav Nachman, who is the head of the yeshiva, who has built and is building this yeshiva, which is located right outside of Alon Shvut in Kfar Zion and across the road from Efrat, those of you who know that area. It's a very beautiful place, spiritually beautiful in terms of the environment. And I think it's just really at the beginning of a major breakthrough that under Rav Nathan's leadership, this yeshiva will be able to make. So we're delighted to have you here. We're delighted to be able to study with you. Rav Nathan has said that he would like to teach us about Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav and Chanukah. And the truth is, whatever you teach, we're ready. And tell us more about that line as you do it too.
Okay, first of all, thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Wexler. It's indeed my honor to be here. Orza Rua has a reputation as being a true place of Limud Torah, of Talmud Torah. It's really an honor for me to be teaching here. I'm not sure exactly where to start or how far back to start or in... what I need to, sort of going blind here a little bit. Rabbi Nachman's Torah, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, has a perspective on the world and a perspective on Jewish spirituality which is unique. It is certainly has elements of the classic Hasidic teachings, but there are also startling new insights. In a sense, Rabbi Nachman himself addresses in his works many of the existentialist issues that we're struggling with in postmodern society. When I first encountered Rabbi Nachman's writings, I was surprised, actually, that the people in his time had found any relevance in them, because they really seem to be speaking very much to some of the issues facing us, those of us who live in a Western society in the postmodern age, where everything is, in a sense, coming apart and being deconstructed and being taken apart, and ideologies of any sort no longer seem to have the same power that they once used to. And at the same time, we're living in an age where there is information beyond imagination at our fingertips, and yet at the same time there seems to be something missing. And even though the information keeps expanding geometrically in orders of magnitude, powers of computer seems to be missing something. And Rabbi Nachman deals with a lot of those issues and many others, issues of darkness, issues of loneliness, issues of alienation, issues of, I would say, tension between people, tension between the sexes, tensions between different groups in society. He doesn't have, with one exception, there is not a definitive Torah on Chanukah. Rabbi Nachman's works are collected in... Rabbi Nachman wrote two books, actually, two main books, none of which are classic books in the sense that we would talk about a book. One is the stories, which were told orally in the last 6 or 7 years of his life. He died in 1811 at the age of 38. The stories were told originally in Yiddish, and shortly after his death, they were translated into Hebrew and written down. Tradition has it that these stories encompass with them some of the deepest and most profound teachings of Rabbi Nachman. And indeed, anyone who has read the stories has a sense that they're, in addition to them being very powerful literature, has a sense that there's some significant things going on beneath the surface. Anyone who hasn't read them, I would recommend reading them. They're a wonderful read. There are a number of translations. The classic translation was Buber's, but I would not recommend that because it's a non-literal translation, and there are various literal translations out there. The other major work of Rabbi Nachman is a book called Likutei Mohoran. Literally means the collections of the sayings of our teacher Rabbi Nachman. And these, in most cases, not in all cases, in most cases, these are the summations of oral teachings that Rabbi Nachman gave over for about over a period of about 15 years, 10 to 15 years. What I say, only 10 to 15 years, Rabbi Nachman was active at a younger age. He became a Rebbe and started teaching at the age of 18, 17, 18. But a few years later, he went on a journey to Eretz Yisrael, 1799, in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, a journey which was his own odyssey. And after he came back, he returned, he said, "The things that I taught before I went to Eretz Yisrael are no longer relevant." And so he threw them all away or burned them. And from then, 1799, until he died in 1811, next 11 years, he would give discourses, teachings, public teachings between 3 and 6 times a year, and sometimes private teachings, and they were later collected. Some during the first part was actually published during his lifetime. They were collected and written down. In most cases, they're not his writing. They're summations. Some cases, he actually reviewed them and went over them. The one thing that's interesting about the book Likutei Mohoran, and then I think after this we can go on to the next thing we want to do, be enough bibliographical information. The thing that's interesting about the book Likutei Mohoran is that Rabbi Nachman himself said about that book and about these teachings, "HaTorah sheli kula hakdamot." My Torah is introduction. What I teach is all introductions. Meaning that it's really like an outline, a very cryptic outline, that when you read it, sometimes the sentences don't even string together into a paragraph. Sometimes they do, but even when they do, it feels very shaky as a narrative. Because it's not really a narrative, it's really meant to be deconstructed. And every one of the sentences in Likutei Mohoran, in a sense, can be peeled back and reveals whole new layers, which can then be peeled back some more and reveal whole new layers. Rabbi Nachman was a master of associative thinking. One of his strategies, not really a strategy, one of the ways in which he looked at the Torah, and maybe we'll get back to this because it's a very important point, one of the ways in which he looked at the Torah was that it's sort of like a holistic, whole dimension, that every point is connected to every other point, and you just have to navigate those connections. So it can be talking about one thing, and then it can remind him in what seems to be almost a very superficial association, and it'll take him in a whole different direction, and that'll take him into a third direction. And the underlying assumption is that the surface of the Torah, and I'm talking now about the entire Torah, the entire material of Jewish spiritual tradition and Jewish spiritual life, that entire tradition, if you would sort of open it up and pick up the cover, you'll see all of these wires, everything's connected. On the surface, when you close the cover, you don't see that. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to open up these passages, show us these connections, show us these points of reference, these points of connection, in order to enable us to understand deeper and to have a deeper experience in both the study of Torah as well as in the practice. And Rabbi Nachman emphasized that these teachings are not meant solely or even primarily as explorations of theory. They are meant primarily as a context for a intensified practice, Jewish spiritual practice. So Rabbi Nachman doesn't write, there's not a particular piece which actually deals with Hanukkah. In a sense, nothing in this book has a clear heading that you can say, oh, this is about Hanukkah, and this is about Shabbat, and this is about something else. It's all ideas which, when you interpret them or when you explore them, you can see how they're connected to some of these other things, and sometimes, you know, we can disagree about, or people can disagree about what the underlying point is. So what I want to do with you tonight, just a little bit, is explore a series of teachings, the chapters in Likutei Moran. Just a technical point, in Hebrew we refer to the chapters as a Torah, right? It's, instead of saying a perek, a chapter, we say a Torah. So there are a series of Torahs in this book, Likutei Moran, which are based, which are interpretations of a number of quotations from the Talmud, from the tractate of Bechorot, which deal with a mythical argument, or hypothetical argument, or maybe a real argument, I don't know, that went on between one of the great sages of the Talmudic, early Talmudic era, someone by the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and the wise men of Athens. Right, there's a series sort of stories, of challenges, and what's interesting is that Rabbi Yochanan, who was the first generation of Emoraim, we're talking the 3rd century, early 3rd century, he is known in Talmudic literature as the Mara Da'atra of Eretz Yisrael. He was the, there wasn't such a position as the chief rabbi, but he was the most important sage in the tradition, the Talmudic tradition of Eretz Yisrael. As you may know, some of you may know, there are parallel traditions. One is the Babylonian tradition, which is primarily explored in the Babylonian Talmud. The other is the Israel tradition, which in some ways is quite different. Rabbi Yochanan was the was considered one of the leading, if not the leading, teacher of the Eretz Yisrael tradition. And the Gemara describes, the Talmud describes, how he entered into a series of interactions. I don't know how to call it. It's interactions. It's some parts of the stories tell about sort of they like challenge each other to these duels, you know, and sometimes they, to, you know, all kind of, I can do this, you can do this, and then there's a continuation of they challenge each other with questions, and then they ask each other riddles. It's very bizarre. Sort of a very bizarre series of stories. And what we know, not just from Rabbi Nachman picks up and develops this idea, that this was seen, this was a description in a rabbinic terminology of a underlying philosophical and spiritual struggle, debate between Greek philosophy, or between what was involved in the Greek perspective of the world, which in a sense is the forerunner of the Western culture, modern Western culture that we live in today, and between the Jewish spiritual tradition, specifically as it developed on its home turf in Eretz Yisrael. And of course, Hanukkah is indeed the holiday that celebrates the struggle, that celebrates the confrontation between a Jewish spiritual tradition and a Western rational tradition. Not that Judaism is not rational, but the modern world, modern science, in a sense, through, of course, many, many centuries of development and of ups and downs, but ultimately we live, the society we live on could be traced back to the foundational principles of Greek philosophy, of the Greek perspective on the world. And that, in some way, was seen, was at a particular time, maybe is today, as diametrically opposed to some of the foundational principles of our spiritual tradition. So there are a dozen of these Torahs, and every one of them reflect a sort of a different angle, a different point. And I believe that the issues that are raised in these debates, in the way Rabbi Nachman saw them, in the way Rabbi Nachman interpreted them, are indeed, if you would sum them all up, you would have the essence of the Hanukkah story from Rabbi Nachman's perspective. So obviously we're going to only be able to do it just a little bit tonight, and let's see, we'll take it where it goes. Unfortunately, I did not have time, and again, I apologize for that, I did not have time to translate the piece, and I didn't even have access to the printed translation of Likutei Moharan with ink, which is not a good one anyway. So it's just in the Hebrew. It's one small piece. It's very dense. That's one small piece. And so what I'll do is I'm going to read it. It's in the part that's framed off. I'm going to read it and translate it as I go along. If you can follow, that's great. If not, it's not long, and and listen, and then we'll see where Rabbi Nachman's going. So in the little bit bolder part at top, it doesn't look that much bolder actually, but in that boxed off area, the very top, it has the letters to the right. It has the letters Kaf Zion. Kaf Zion, this is the 27th Torah in Likutei Moharan. And the first line is the challenge that they, we're now at this place of the Torahs that deal with the challenges. So they said to him as follows, Ritzitza demayet bibiute, a chicken not yet born, a fetus of a chicken, I don't know what you call it, inside the egg, right? The ritzitza demaye, that died, bebeuta, in the egg. A chicken that dies inside the egg. Hecha?
Embryo.
Chicken embryo. Thank you. Hecha nafek rucha. Where does its wind go out from? Where does its soul go out from? Literally, ruach means winds. Where does its life force? How does it go out? It's in the egg, right? Can't get out. So that's the question that they asked him. So what did he answer? Amar lahu, he said to them, Bahainu de'ala, the same way it got in. Goes out the same way it got in. End of confrontation. Tense, right? What the heck is... What?
Get in.
Right. Okay. So that's the story in the Gemara. And by the way, every one of these stories, every one of these challenges, every one of these questions, all are perceived or presented by the Gemara as a major victory for Rabbi Yochanan, major victory for our side. Okay, so we don't understand the question, we don't understand the answer, we don't understand why it seems like a major victory. They're shocked that he knew the answer to that question. That question somehow is a major challenge, and he knew the answer. So now Rabbi Nachman's going to not yet explain, because the way these Torahs are set up is that he'll first present a thesis, first present an idea, and ultimately at some point he'll work his way back to explaining the core text itself. Aleph. Right, so now we've left the Gemara. That was a quote from the Talmud. We left the Talmud, and we're now reading from Likutei Moharan, Rabbi Nachman's language. Kilim shoch et kol ha'olam la'avodato la'avdo shechem echad, to pull, to bring the entire world to serve God and to serve him united, shechem echad, shoulder to shoulder. Vekulam yashlichu elilei kaspam uzahavam, and all will throw their idols of silver and gold, throw them away. Viyitpalalu el Hashem yitbarach levad, and will pray to the Holy One, blessed be He, alone. That reality, Zehadavar, that concept or that idea, that ideal, Nase bekol dor vador lefi hashalom shebador. It's accomplished in every generation according to the shalom of that generation. Ki al yedei hashalom sheyesh ben bnei adam. For by the shalom, by the peace, by the harmony that exists between people, vehem chokrim umazbirim ze leze haemet. What does it mean, says Rabbi Nachman, that what is the shalom between people? The fact that they explore and investigate and explain to each other the truth. That's what Rabbi Nachman calls shalom, calls peace. It's not just coexistence, but it's proactive coexistence, that we're explaining to each other what the truth is. Al yedei ze, by this process of explaining the truth to each other, mashlich kol ish et sheker elilei kaspo, everyone will throw away their ideals of deceit, of falsehood, right? The ideals of money, which are sheker, umekarev et atzmo la'emet, and will bring himself closer to the truth. Ve'if shar, next paragraph, if shar lavo lebchinat shalom, it is impossible to come to this aspect of truth, ella al yedei of peace. Thank you, right, of peace. Ella al yedei he'arat panim hadrat panim. Only, one can only come to this by the aspect of the light of the face. He'arat panim, the light of the face.
It's welcoming.
Well, not sure what it is. We'll get to it. And hadrat panim. Hadrat panim means the
beautification.
Beautification. The hadar usually means, how would you
dignity.
Say hadar?
Dignity.
Dignity, thank you. The dignity of the face, right? The light of the face and the dignity of the face. Vezeh, and this is alluded to in the verse in the book of Bereishit, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. And Yaakov came whole to the city of Shechem. Itaruta, it was awakened, Bechinat La'avdo Shechem Echad, the aspect of serving God shoulder to shoulder. V'hu al yedei shalom, which we already said is by peace, comes by harmony. V'shalom hu al yedei b'chinat Yaakov, and peace comes into the world by the aspect of the concept of Yaakov, Jacob. Shehu he'arat panim, which is the aspect of the light of the face. B'chinat shufrei de Yaakov, ke'ein shufrei de Adam. As we have learned in the Talmud and Baba Metzia, that the face of Jacob was as the face of Adam, of Adam. V'ze b'chinat, and this is an aspect of the verse in Tehillim, Psalms, Mevakshei panecha Yaakov, we seek your face, Jacob. One more line, and we'll try to make some sense of this. V'hadrat panim, the dignity of the face. Ze b'chinat drushei Torah. This is an aspect of the drash, of the exploration of Torah. Shehatorah nidreshet b'shloshesrei midot. Because the Torah is explored through the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael, famous Braita, the 13 ways in which we explore Torah. Hanim shachim mitleisar tikune dikna, and these 13 ways of exploring the Torah come from the 13 aspects of the face. That's a quote in the Zohar. Explain that too. Mebchinat hadrat panim, an aspect of the, this is an aspect of dignity, the dignity of the face. Kamosha katuv v'hadarta p'nei zaken, and you shall honor, you shall dignify the face of the older, of the elder. So is, okay, now do you understand the essence of Hanukkah? Right, this is dense stuff. So first of all, let's review what he said without understanding at all. So Rabbi Nachman said the following thing. He talked about unifying the world in the service of Hashem. And notice the emphasis on unifying the world. It's sort of like this universal vision of spirituality. So that's one thing he talked about. What that means is that everyone is standing shoulder to shoulder, right? So it's not necessarily about individual people having a personal relationship, a personal spiritual relationship, but that this aspect or this bechina of the world serving, the whole world being in a place of service of God, has to come about through people standing to shoulder, and the peace that is amongst them. And then he taught us that the peace, the harmony that is amongst the people that are standing shoulder to shoulder is about each person turning to the person next to them and explaining to them the aspect of truth. As a result of this unity, as a result of this togetherness, as a result of this standing shoulder to shoulder, so people will throw away their false idols of gold and silver, meaning they will detach themselves from a worldview driven by consumerism, to translate it into modern phrase, which I thought was particularly apt. I was thinking about this because when you're in New York, I mean, I know you're all used to it. You see it all the time. When you're in New York in December, so I want to say two things. And this is in parentheses, but it's important. That's why I'm saying it. First of all, one of them is going to get me fired from the Guild of Rabbis, so don't, if there's such a guild, so don't pass it out beyond this room. So usually when Israelis, and I actually met someone before, also someone from Israel, and he said, oh, it's so hard for me in December. I see all these Christmas lights and holidays. Oh, I can't stand it. Next time I'm not going to come. So I love it. I think it's beautiful. That was the thing that's going to get me fired. But the...
That's two of us.
Okay, good. We'll go down together. But the other thing, which is always so striking to me, is, you know, so people are, of course, the shops are full, the stores are packed, people are rushing around with the shopping bags, shopping. That's fine. But it catches my eye, these advertisements. I saw one just before, as I was waiting for a cab. I saw it on a cab, actually, which was full. And there's advertisements, I'm sure you see that it said, what will love be this year? Or show what love is this year. Something like that. It was a wonderful, beautiful sentiment. And it's advertised for diamonds, to buy diamonds. In other words, the translation of a concept which is beautiful and deep, and the forced translation of that, and if it's not going to be manifested, if it's not going to be expressed in a diamond ring or whatever it was they were advertising there, then that's not love, or you haven't shown true love. So that's what Rabbi Nachman's talking about when he says that people will throw away there are false idols of gold and silver. He means that will not be the defining reality of people's spiritual and emotional experience. It's important in a physical sense, but it won't. Emotional and spiritual truths do not need to be affirmed by physical or consumer or material dimensions. So, right, so we said back in parentheses, right, so Rabbi Nachman says that people will throw away those idols. So that's the first point, right, this sort of that unity, universalism, truth we've seen, standing together. The second point Rabbi Nachman is making is that to be able to get to that place of peace and harmony, You have to have two things, or you come to it by two truths, or two realities, two spiritual realities. One is called He'arat Panim, the other is called Hadrat Panim. One is when you have light, your face is full of light. The other is when your face is full of dignity. It's your face and the people that you're interacting with, as well as the face of the world. Light and dignity. And the light one gets to by... he doesn't explain in this short piece how one gets to the light, but he does say that it's connected, the light, the person whose face, who was the person, the biblical character, who in a sense got to this place of light, that was Yaakov. How do I know that Yaakov got to this place of light? Because he actually came to the city of Shechem, and he came shalem, and he came whole. And Shechem is shoulder to shoulder. And he came to that place, and we know, says Rabbi Nachman, because I've told you that a precondition to come to that place of wholeness is the dimension of light. And so therefore, Yaakov is the person whose face is full of light. How do we know that Yaakov's face is full of light? Because the Talmud tells me that Yaakov's face was the exact face of Adam. Why is Adam's face full of light? At the Medrash tells us. Adam's and Eve also, Adam and Chava, shone like the sun. I guess if we had been in the Garden of Eden, our faces would shine like the sun also. Or is there some transcendent dimension to Yaakov's life, to Adam's life, to Adam's life, that was so full of bliss, that was so full of light, that was so powerful, that it was imprinted in his face. When you looked at his face, you could see that this person had come from the blessed realm. He had come from someplace special.
Why didn't he mention Moses? Where it says distinctly his face shone.
It's a good question. What was the result of Moshe's face shining with light?
He had a cover. It
seemed good.
Had a cover. Which tells me what? That the light that was coming from Moshe was out of sync with the rest of the world. It was so startling. It was so out of harmony. It's not a critique of Moshe. That it had to be hidden. Not Adam's light, not Adam's light. That was much more natural, meaning that it was in a place where it was whole in the world. Adam and Yaakov's face, the Gemara tells us, was like the face of Adam. We don't hear that Yaakov had to cover his face. So you can have light and you can have light. And the question is, what's the relationship between you and the world around you? So that's an exploration of Moshe, which we're not doing now. Moshe and how he's a part of, how he brings the light down into the world. And, you know, I just add that Moshe struggled throughout his entire life. Moshe struggled to build a relationship with the people around him. Because it's hard, right? He's coming from this completely different reality, and he comes into the world, and it's hard for him to deal with people. I don't want to psychoanalyze Moshe here, but it's hard for him to deal with people because he doesn't fully... can't buy into their shortcomings, into their limits, into their issues, and so he can't deal. And he can't even deal with his wife, among other people. Again, it's not meant as a critique of Moshe, it's just meant as a description. Yaakov, yeah?
I don't understand how Moshe did not come from the group of people he was leading, could you clarify?
How he did not come from...
Come from the very group that he was known by.
Yeah, it's a tangent. It's a tangent. It's a tangent. Okay. It's off in a totally different direction. So Yaakov, Adam HaRishon, the first Adam's face was full of light because he had an interaction with God that was unprecedented and not followed by anyone else. Yaakov's face is like Adam, like Adam. That means his face is full of light. And so he's able to bring that type of universal wholeness and peace. It's ironic. Ironic is the wrong word. It's really harsh, actually, to bring Yaakov and his appearance before the city of Shechem as the classic example of peace and harmony to all human beings, because we all know what happened just a few verses later when the city is in ruins, and Dina is raped, the city is in ruins and killed and destroyed. There's a lot of blood and guts in that story. It doesn't sound like an example peace and harmony onto all mankind or humankind. Seder, that's a point. We'll get to that because that's a very important understanding of what happened there. But Rabbi Nachman at this point is using Yaakov to show that light, face of light, whatever that means, face of light is what you need in order to come to this place of harmony and wholeness. And what's the other thing that you need? It's the face of dignity. What's dignity? Says Rabbi Nachman, how do you get to this face of dignity? So you get to that, and here is a little bit of Kabbalistic imagery. Rabbi Nachman talks about the 13 aspects of the face. That's a Kabbalistic term, 13 tikkuni didikna. And the 13, of course, is going to be the key number. I told you Rabbi Nachman's associative thinking. He knows from the Zohar that there are 13 points in the face, or 13 aspects, 13 holy aspects of the human face, which represent God's divinely given attributes, and that's considered the dignity of the human face, is because it has these 13 divine manifestations. And of course 13 to Rabbi Nachman immediately tells him it's about the 13 principles by which we expound Torah. And so to go to this place of dignity, it's about revelations and revealing in Torah. To go to the place of light, he doesn't tell us how you go there, but these are the two necessary components in order to get to this place of wholeness. Okay, so that's the piece in Likutei Moharan. How much time do I have here?
9:30.
Good, because I need about another 4 hours.
We'll see.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit more. Now we're going to go to Hanukkah for a minute. We'll keep this in the back of our mind, and I want to talk a little about Hanukkah. So the Hanukkah story, we know beyond what the kids are taught in kindergarten, what I was taught in kindergarten, it's all about a war between, right, the Greeks and the Jews, and the Jews want to be free, and et cetera, right? Beyond that, we know that primarily the Hanukkah story is about a struggle between two great civilizations. As I mentioned before, between the Greek civilization in its Hellenized form, in its Eastern form, not in its original Greek form, and between a Jewish spiritual tradition. The Hanukkah story is seen in mystical and Hasidic perspective as a moment, as a defining moment in Jewish spiritual history. As the moment when Jews, in a sense, began set out on a path which becomes the ultimate Jewish spiritual path. And you can divide the Jewish spiritual history into two points, into two parts. Before Hanukkah, B.C., and after Hanukkah.
It's going good.
Why? What's so incredibly significant about Hanukkah? So, got to go back to the beginning of the first, Second Temple. Right? Throughout history in Jewish tradition, from Sinai, from the revelation at Sinai, how did Jews know what to do? How did Jews receive spiritual guidance? Through revelation, through prophecy. There are different levels of prophecy. There were whole schools of prophecy, according to the Tanakh. So there was always, according to Jewish tradition, there was always a oral tradition which was revealed at Sinai in whatever way, shape, or form, and it was passed down from generation to generation. But primarily that tradition was static, meaning that it didn't give you guidance in new realities. What it could do is it could connect you to the past. It could connect you to the tradition. And if you happen to be in the place of doing what it was that the tradition tells you to do, or in some reality that the tradition knew about, you can have the Jewish perspective on whatever needed to be done. But in any new situation, it wasn't helpful to you, because it was static. It was passed down. The tradition that you had in your generation was the same in a previous generation, same in a previous generation, same in a previous generation. So in new situations, new realities, it wasn't helpful to you. So what would you do if you needed an insight, if you needed guidance in a new situation? You'd go to the Navi. You'd go to the prophet. The prophets are called, in the Tanakh, they're called Haro'eh, the seer, the seer, and you would go there for personal spiritual advice. So personal advice, there's a number of examples in the Tanakh. The most famous one is King Saul, before he was king, went to ask personal advice from the prophet, from the Navi of his time. That continued not only in the First Temple period, but that continued into the Second Temple period. And there was an institution which we know, rabbis tell us, was called the Knesset HaGdolah, the Great Assembly, in which there were prophets, or primarily prophets, as well as other people. We know some of the prophets by name. Remember, we don't know all the prophets by name, but we know even the names of some of the prophets at the beginning of the Second Temple period. And even when there were no longer prophets in the world, the last prophet is Malachi, lives towards the end of the first century into the Second Temple. Malachi dies, there are no longer Nevi'im, there are no longer prophets, but there is still the energy of prophecy in the world. And there were people who had what is known, or what is called, as Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit or Divine Spirit. There were people who were more sensitive, more aware. They weren't full prophets, but they were able to connect to and to link into this prophetic energy, and they were able to continue to give guidance using that aspect of their spiritual powers. The last person, or the end of that period, we're told in Ethics of the Fathers, was someone by the name of Shimon HaTzadik, who probably was the high priest. It's not 100% clear. And he is Shiarei Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. He was the last of the men of the Great Assembly. And when he died, that energy, that spiritual process, was no longer in the world. It ceased, it ended. And he lived at the time of the Greek conquest of Eretz Israel. There's a story in the Talmud, there are a number of stories in various versions, how he goes out to greet Alexander the Great. We're talking about the 330s, more or less, before the year zero. Shimon HaTzadik goes out to greet Alexander, and Alexander promises, very impressed, promises he's never going to do anything bad to the Jewish people. Shimon HaTzadik dies, and the Greeks take over. The Greeks begin to rule Eretz Israel. For the first 150 years, it's the Egyptian Greeks, and then it becomes the Assyrian Greeks. That period, we know very little about. It's one of the black holes of Jewish history. It's one of the times in Jewish history that we know very little. We have know very few of our own traditions, which talk about what happened there. There's no corroborating outs, external evidence, except for here and there, a few lines in Josephus. It's very empty. We know more, a lot more, about earlier periods than we do about that period of time. The only thing we know, when do we start knowing again? When do we know more? Starting from the story of the Maccabees, 165 before the year zero. So there's about 150, 160, 170 years that we know very little about. The only thing we know is that the Jews entered into that period of time more or less continuing to live as they had for generations beyond count, and came out of that period. There was a substantial number of Jews that were assimilated, quasi-assimilated into Greek culture and into Greek life. Sometime in that 170 years, that happened. Didn't happen overnight, obviously. 170 years is five, six generations. But it happened during that period of time. And the only thing we know from our own tradition in that period of time is that there was no more prophetic energy in the world. There's no more Ruach HaKodesh in the world. So it's this sort of empty place. And what we do know is that the Jews in the land of Israel at that time encountered the most advanced, most sophisticated, most modern culture of its time, Greek culture. And so obviously it's not a huge guess, is that the meeting was devastating for us, for the Jews. Now something happened, again this is connected to the Hanukkah story, something happened at the beginning of the Hanukkah rebellion. Most people don't think about it, most people don't know about it, they're not paying attention. But what that one thing happened was so dramatic that it is the most significant aspect of the whole story. Far more significant for Jewish history than defeating the Greeks or reconquering the temple. It's a little story that's told in the first book of Maccabees, which, by the way, is considered among historians to be a very accurate historical book, written by a participant in probably the armies of Judah the Maccabee, contemporary historical account of what happened. And he tells this little story in the second chapter about how there were people in Jerusalem who fled from Jerusalem because they wanted to keep Shabbat. One of the things that the Greeks did was they decreed that it is prohibited to keep Shabbat. They decreed three things, according to our tradition. They prohibited Sabbath observance. They prohibited the process of the calendar. Of that time, the calendar was established monthly, right? The whole process, the witnesses, the new moon, they prohibited that. And they prohibited the circumcision, which they saw as a personal affront to the beauty and the wholeness of the human body. So the book of Maccabees tells, first book of Maccabees tells how these Jews ran into the desert and the Greeks caught up with them or came after them and besieged them, and they fought back because it was already at the beginning of the rebellion, and Matthew had already raised, and his children and his sons had already raised the standard of revolt, so they were fighting back. And then along came Shabbat, and they put down their arms and they said, "We don't fight on Shabbat." And the Greeks took advantage of that and killed them all. And then Matityahu, the story in the book of Maccabees says that Matityahu said to his sons, "This can't be." I'm paraphrasing now. "This can't be. This is not what Judaism is about. This is God wants us to live, not to die. And therefore, we're allowed to fight on Shabbat." So why is that? That's a story in the book of Maccabees. Why is that so powerful? So first of all, there's a parallel to that discussion in the Talmud. The Talmud doesn't quote it in the name of Matityahu, quotes it anonymously. There's a discussion about whether or not you're allowed to fight on Shabbat, whether or not you're allowed to do anything on Shabbat that's about pikuach nefesh, about saving a life. And the Gemara says that you look at a pasuk, and they're doresh a pasuk, right? They use these 13 principles in order to explore a particular pasuk. There's two psukim, there's two verses in the Torah. One is about fighting, adrikata, one is about general life on Shabbos, life-saving situations. And they come to the conclusion that Torah is about life, and Shabbos, with all its importance, is nidche. Shabbos is less important than maintaining life. That is a classic example of what drash is, of what it means to use these principles that the rabbis gave us to explore the verses of the Torah and to take out from that a new halacha, meaning a new halachic understanding that goes against the previous halachic understanding. You have to understand that if these people were said we can't fight on Shabbat, that must have been the understood halacha. That must have been the accepted norm. They weren't just making it up on the spot. They knew that that's what religious Jews did, and they were running away from Jerusalem to be religious Jews. So of course they're not going to do anything on Shabbat. That was for how long back was that the accepted norm? Don't know. It was always that way, or not always that way. But certainly at that time, that was what people thought the halacha was. And Matityahu looked at the verses in the Torah. We know it's Matityahu from the story in the Book of Maccabees. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. It would just be anonymous in the Talmud. And he said no. What that means? Why is that so significant? It's enormous significance. Because that means that oral Torah, as we understand it today, and ever since then, not oral Torah, not the oral tradition as it was in the previous 1,000 years or so, or more, 1,500 years when it was first given, where it was a static tradition given over from generation to generation, also called the oral tradition, not that oral tradition, but the oral tradition of rabbinic process by which one uses accepted principles and explores the verses of the Torah in order to reveal, in order to michadesh, new insights about halachic process and halachic behavior, that began with Matityahu. That began at the time of the Maccabees. So it's enormous. As a matter of fact, the Maharal of Prague is one of the great thinkers, one of the great Jewish thinkers of the late medieval period or early modern period, depending on how you look at it. Prague, 1500s, known, unfortunately today, outside of scholarly circles, for creating a golem, which is a good trick, but really he was a very, very profound and seminal thinker. So he has a book about Hanukkah, and what I just told you now is not my chidush, his. He says that the essence of the Hanukkah story is that it revealed the process of the oral Torah, revealed the process of a creative understanding of Torah, which allows you to constantly innovate and to constantly be a part of the process, as opposed to being a passive observer of the process. Now let's go back to the piece we read in Rabbi Nachman. It's the end, right? We're starting from the end of this piece. So Rabbi Nachman says, right, that in order to be at peace, in order to be whole, you need the face of dignity. That's the second thing you need. The face of dignity is about being mechadesh in Torah, about revealing new dimensions of Torah, which is connected to the 13 principles by which we expound the Torah. That says Rabbi Nachman is what you need to go to the place of peace, of wholeness. Now think about this for a minute. The Greek culture, Hellenistic culture, was the first instant that we know of in history, recorded history, of a global culture that transcended ethnic and national boundaries. Any culture that existed beforehand was inherently defined by a national and ethnic group. Why did Hellenism, Greek philosophy, why was it international in scope? Why was it sort of global in scope? Because it was built on an understanding of extreme rationalism. The human mind can create all kind of ideas, all kind of perspectives. Anyone can do that. Doesn't matter what language you speak. It doesn't matter even what religion you practice, ultimately. You can go to that place of rational human understanding and meet on a human-to-human basis, on a mind-to-mind basis, in a sense. And when you meet on a mind-to-mind basis, so it doesn't just remain as a mind thing, as we see in our own time, that once the connection is made between people across boundaries, across cultural divides, across ethnic divides, there's a meeting of the mind, so to speak. You read this play, I read this play, right, this Greek tragedy. You read this tragedy, I appreciate it, you appreciate it. In the end, so why am I wearing a different shirt than you are? If the shirt I was wearing was somehow the ethnic costume, right, my tradition, what does it matter anymore? To wear my costume, your costume. What does it matter anymore? My, the food that I traditionally ate, the food that you traditionally ate. We can eat what's good. You can eat my food. I can eat your food. That's not important. It didn't start from there, but it ends up there. It begins when you talk about concepts. But in the end, it comes down to Coca-Cola and Nike sneakers. In the end, Not that that's all it is, but it manifests itself. And you can see that, by the way, if you look at modernity, you can see that the ideas of globalization started as ideas, as concepts. And then it translates into all dimensions of human existence. So that was Greek culture. That was Hellenistic culture. Sounds great. Sounds, peaceful, of peace and harmony to all mankind. Sounds something ideal. But what's missing, of course, is God. Why is it significant that God's missing? Because human rationality and human intellectual perspective that is not anchored in understanding that God is present in all of our thought processes, or at least needs to be, ultimately leads to arrogance, to nihilism, to self-centeredness, to the me generation, to an egocentric life in which the gratification of my needs, and even if I'm not going to hurt you, I'm not talking about when I'm people who are going to take it to a extreme and turn it into a pathology, that I'm going to gratify my needs by doing something bad to you, even if I don't do that. The gratification of my needs becomes the dominant essence of my existence. And that in turn leads to alienation, to fragmentation, to loneliness. So on the surface, and again, you can see it today, if it wasn't today, it'd be hard to understand these concepts, but we can see it with all the differences relative to modernity, we can see the way this is being played in our own time. That the globalization does not lead to increased,
well-being,
spiritual, emotional, psychological neighborliness, let's say. It doesn't. It should, but it doesn't. And the opposite, everybody talks about now, and everybody's writing about the breakdown of everything. Breakdown of neighborhood, the breakdown of family, the breakdown of, I mean, whatever social interactions and whatever communities, and in small towns it's less, and in big cities it's more, because there's more globalization. Globalization's felt more intensely, so the breakdown is more. I'm oversimplifying because it's much more complex than that. So Rabbi Nachman says, listen, the struggle on Hanukkah, he doesn't say Hanukkah, but the struggle is between a rational intellectual process which leads to a globalization in which God is not present, and therefore will ultimately lead to at first to a superficial oneness, but ultimately to a fragmentation of that oneness. That's on one side. And the struggle that's against that is the struggle to create a universalist society which will be rooted in not chokhmah, not intellectual wisdom, but in chokhmat hakodesh, in intellectual wisdom, which is rooted in and grounded in the attempt to reveal new divine truths in the world. That's not all, but that's the root, that's the grounding. And that's why it had to be that in order to combat, in order to confront the Greek version of globalization, the Greek version of intellectual process, it had to be that the Jewish version of it came into the world at that time. It had to be. Now, which came first? The Greek attempt to, or not attempt, the Greek conquest of the world, or the Jewish antidote to that? I mean, looking at it from a divine perspective, so it's all the same. You know, God's like this incredible chess player that's moving pieces in the way in which the world has developed. Now, you could say, why did that happen at all? Because, of course, we know it had to happen, because as society develops and grows up, goes on, it needs more human interaction, right? There's more partnership. Many people have written about that. Divine human partnership. Okay, so in order to be a partner, you have to be a participant, you have to be creative, you have to use rational thought process, you have to understand how to think, you have to, all of those things, and all of those things need to come into the world, and they come into the world in a Greek version of it, and they come into the world in a Jewish spiritual version of it. So that's the dignity, Rabbi Nachman says. The Torah exploration allows you to come to that place of wholeness, that place of peace, which comes not from a superficial likeness, but comes from a deeper place of we meet and connect from the human aspect, from the human divine soul that we have. And that universalism does not have to translate into the loss of uniqueness, because that's another outcome of superficial oneness without God. So because it's without God, and because it's so superficial, and because it touches all those things we talked about before, so the emphasis on the external becomes ever more heightened. Because deep down inside, maybe on a subconscious level, maybe on an unconscious level, deep down inside, you know that you're not really at peace or at one with the person next to you. So you become ever more driven, but you know that you're supposed to be, right? All these are subconscious, unconscious, you know you're supposed to be, so it becomes ever more significant that you wear the same clothes. As opposed to a deeper universalism, which comes from a exploration of the divine human commonality that we have with each other because of the souls that all human beings have, which can also have in it a deep respect for the uniqueness of each and every individual and each and every culture. So that's the dignity Rabbi Nachman is talking about, coming to the wholeness, to the peace. Let's go one step back before that. So the thing before that, Rabbi Nachman said, is the light. The light. You need a face of light. You need a dimension of light to get to that type of peace, that type of universalism that I'm talking about. what's the example? Rabbi Nachman here doesn't say how to get to it, but he brings an example of Yaakov. Yavo Yaakov Shalem LeYerushalayim. Yaakov came whole to the city of Shechem. Why is that a proof text that light brings you peace? The face of light brings you peace. So here I have to quote a different Torah in Likutei Moran in chapter 23, Torah Kaf Gimel. Rabbi Nachman explains a bizarre story, quote, that the Talmud says about Yaakov when he came to Shechem and what he did when he came there. And it says as follows. It's a famous Medrash. Yaakov tikein matbeya b'Shechem. Yaakov came to the city of Shechem and he established a economic system. He established the rudimentary foundations of an economy. He, in the words of the Gemara, he tikein matbeya. He established coinage. To understand that to establish coinage means that you're taking the economy out from a pre-modern barter economy into a cash economy. Once it's a cash economy, so there's a whole series of things that result of having a cash economy. Yaakov came to Shechem and he set up this economic system. It's crazy. But first of all, what does that mean? That's what he was doing. He remember the story? He struggles with Esav. He wrestles with him. He loses to the angel, or he's wounded by the angel. He overcomes his brother. And then he comes whole and in one piece to the city of Shechem. And then the Midrash says, as soon as he got there, what he did is he set up this economic system. So Rabbi Nachman explains that Yaakov sensed, this is Yaakov's first appearance into the land of Israel ever since he was a kid, and his reintroduction back into the life of the country. And Yaakov saw the people of Shechem, and he saw Shechem was a great merchant city, so there are crossroads. And he saw that they were completely consumed by their, driven by their need to get rich. And he felt, he saw, right? This is paraphrasing Rabbi Nachman, this is not me, that the whole system, that was a bad thing, right? It can't be. He felt that the land of Israel, these are not Jews, these are not his family, but these are the people that are living in Eretz Israel, land of Israel. And so he feels a responsibility, and he wants to take them out of that mindset. He wants to take them out of that materialistic, driven by the need to achieve ever and ever higher levels of material wealth. And so he sets up for them an economy, sets up for them a system. Says Rabbi Nachman in chapter 23 of Likutei Moran, that what he was doing was he was fixing or trying to fix the curse of Adam. What was the curse of Adam? B'zeat apecha tochal lechem. With the bread, with the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread. What does that mean? With the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread. Doesn't mean it's going to be hard. At least not the way Rabbi Nachman explains it. Doesn't mean it's going to be hard. It means it's going to consume you. It's going to be full of anguish and angst and stress. That's what it means. That's the curse that Adam HaRishon was given. Now, why was he given that particular curse? Because when Adam and Chava were put into the Garden of Eden, they lived in harmony with the world around. And what God said to them, and again, that's a whole different story, which I don't want to go into now, but God said to them, you broke the harmony, and the result of that breaking is you are now no longer going to live in a harmonious relationship, not as a curse, but as a result. You're no longer going to live in harmony with the world around. You're going to be living in a power struggle with the world around, the physical world around you. You're going to push ever more to dominate it. you're going to push to get ever more so you can be higher up on the totem pole. That's a result of the breaking of the harmony. That's not a curse. Adam goes from harmony to strife. By the way, I would add in parentheses, that's exactly the second part of the curse, that Adam and Chava, the second part of the curse, the famous line that certain parts of the Jewish community tend to quote whenever they want to support their continued suppression of women, and they'll say, what does it say? Before that, Elishech teshukatech v'hu yimshol bach. See, it says that man should rule over woman. Of course, it's a curse, right? But the truth is, it's not about man over woman. Elishech teshukatech is the other part of it. Basically, and this is just in parentheses, but it's important to say, basically, what God is telling to Adam and Chava is that you broke the harmony of the world, and now you're not going to live anymore in harmony and sync with each other. It's going to be a hierarchy now. It's going to be a struggle. One time, one person will be on top, the other person, the other will be on top, but it's going to be a struggle. It's a power struggle. It's become a power struggle. Male-female relationships, gender relationships, have become, says God to Adam and Chava, have become a power struggle, as is the relationship between the human beings and the surrounding physical world. So what it means to be in a power struggle with the world, as I said before, means you constantly want to dominate, you constantly want more of it. The more of it you have, the more of it that's subservient to you, the more of it that's under your thumb, the more you're in control, the more you're higher up. And so that idea, or that curse, is what drives all of humans' relationships to the material realm, unless you can get past the curse. And although the curse can't be fixed cosmically until the end of days, but it can be fixed locally. You can fix it in your square yard, or the person next to you. Right? You can fix it. You don't have to be in that struggle. You can come back to a place of harmony. The world as a whole can't. So Yaakov comes to Shechem, and for all kind of reasons, again, which have to do with a deep exploration of the Parsha. It's actually this week's Parsha. See, we got even a little bit Parsha Shavua, almost this week's Parsha. Yaakov understands that he must, in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, he must rebalance. He must create again that place of wholeness, that place of shleimut, that place of togetherness. And so he has taken upon himself to fix the city of Shechem, to fix the people, to create for them an economic system which will allow them to prosper but not consume them. He creates work hours, right? It's a whole thing. So how's that connected again to our Torah over here? That to get to that place of peace, you have to have a face of light. To have a face of light, you have to step back from the all-embracing passion of the material world. You don't have to leave it, but you have to order it, as Yaakov did in Shechem. You have to put it in its place. You have to put it in its appropriate priority. You can't leave it where it is, because if you leave it where it is, then it will become the most powerful aspect of your life. And again, we know from our own time, I'm sure everybody knows stories of people whose lives were consumed by that and destroyed by that to a certain extent. So that is the opposite of light. Light manifests or reflects the priority of a connection to the divine. A person who's able to control, a person who's able to put in its proper place the aspects of the physical world, the material world, not leave them. We're not into going into the desert and leaving everything behind. It's not a vow of poverty, not the Jesuits. But to put it in its proper place, its proper importance and priority. If you can do that, you will have a face of life. Just as if you could create in Torah and you could become involved in the process of creating and of generating new insights into Torah, you will have a face of dignity. The dignity and the light are the prerequisites for creating the peace, the wholeness that we talked about before. The wholeness that comes from a human process that's rooted in a divine encounter. That's the peace that we're talking about. That's the peace that Rabbi Nachman is talking about. And that, says Rabbi Nachman, although again, he doesn't say it in his Torah, that is the explanation. Now let's go back to the, this is a whole long Torah, but this that little piece over there we started with, right, the egg, right, the embryo, the chicken embryo that dies, goes in, goes out. So the chicken, the embryo, the shell, that's a very complicated metaphor which is connected to a different piece in this Torah. So I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on the last piece. How does it, Rabbi Yochanan, they say to him, how does it go out? He says, how's it, the way it comes in? Meaning that the struggle in Hanukkah, the Hanukkah struggle, it's not about going somewhere else. It's not about doing something different than the culture that we were confronting. It's about doing the same thing, but in a different way. It's not about being anti-rational and anti-intellectual. It's about being rational and intellectual in a different way. It's not about you not being universal. It's about being universal in a different way. It's not about moving away. Here's a whole different thing that we didn't talk about it, but I'll just sort of mention a couple of sentences, because this is the other piece of Greek culture, as I mentioned, is the concept of beauty. So it's not about beauty. It's not about not having beauty, right? That was traditionally associated in Greece with beauty. It's not about not having beauty, but it's having a different kind of beauty. It's about having a beauty which emphasizes the wholeness, the harmony, the symmetry in the spiritual worlds as well as in the physical worlds. So it's not about moving away from beauty, it's about a different type of beauty. It's not about moving away from material wealth, because after all, Hanukkah was also about reconsecrating the temple. Reconsecrating the temple was a reconsecration of the avoda, of the service of Hashem in the temple, which was gold and silver. So it's not about moving away from the material world, about ignoring it, about negating it. It's about living in a different way. It's about living in a place of life. It's about human intellectual and rational process, but from a place of dignity, which is a place of awareness of God's presence, God's encounter. So this is the where it goes out, where it comes in. The tikkun, the fixing of Greek culture. And it's the striking similarities to today are striking. The fixing is not about turning away from it. The fixing is about fixing. It's about living it in a different way. Living it with a different perspective, with a different focus. Now, all of this sort of insight, Rabbi Nachman, it's an insight. Rabbi Nachman's primary student, Talmud, talks in Likutei Halachot. He has an 8-volume work on the Shulchan Aruch, on the laws, Jewish life. He talks about looking at the candles. He talks about lighting the candles and looking at the flame. Not using them. Right? That's what the tradition says. We don't use. That's why we had the Shamash, so we shouldn't by accident use one of the lit candles. Why do we need to look at the candles but not use the candles? So he explains as follows, and I'll end with this thought. When you use the candles, that gives the candles a dimension of what he calls fire. When you don't use them, you just look at them, that turns them into light. The difference between light and fire, says Rabbi Nathan, is the difference between all of the positive usages of the ideas that I talked about, as opposed to flame, to fire, which is perceived as destructive, which is the negative side of all of those things. In other words, to use material culture, to be consumed by material culture, to be driven by material culture, is manifested in a flame. To use material culture in order to do good in the world and to affirm God's place in the world is an aspect of light. To use human rational thought process to acquire ever more knowledge and therefore become ever more self-centered and alienated is fire. To use human rational intellectual process as part of a God encounter to reveal new creative perspectives on how to bring God into the world and how to live a spiritual life, that's light. To use beauty as an end in its own right and therefore to demean beauty is fire. To use beauty as a manifestation, as an expression of the beauty of the world, the harmony and the symmetry that God created the world until we messed it up a little bit, that's light. So as we look, says Rabbi Nathan, as we look at the Hanukkah candles, as we look at them, let's take a few minutes, when lights the candles, we look at them, but don't use them. So we are reminding ourselves that this holiday is about light and not about fire. It's about fixing the way it goes in, it's the way it goes out. It's not about doing something different. It's about refocusing and reusing those same basic concepts, but this time from a place of holiness. So, I just want to say, and then maybe if anybody has any questions, this Torah itself, this Torah itself, we barely touched this chapter. And there are 10 or 12 of these which deal with the Hanukkah story. So I figure that if you invite me back next year, about before Hanukkah too, in a year after, figuring about 25 years, we'll get through the full perspective of Rabbi Nachman as perspective on Hanukkah as it related in these stories. So hang in there.
Yes, it's coffee. It's a pleasure. And if you still have any energy, stick around. Otherwise, good night. Thank you very much.
Just two comments.
Yes.
There's a prayer I say every morning, and I knew it was important, but I never understood the full meaning of it until you spoke about light. And that's.